You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 23rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Columbia professor of religion, Gary Dorian, on the new abolition, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the black social gospel. Also on the program today, Michal Rozersky, a Toronto-based union researcher and writer, blogger at The Political Economy, on why we fight Uber. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is a pre-tape. You could argue we've begun our vacation, but you're still getting completely fresh new content. Mind-blowing content, ladies and gentlemen, right now as we speak. Well, no. Let me rephrase that. As we speak, I'm speaking. But as you hear this, there's a very good chance I am on a plane to Michigan to see my in-laws with my screaming children and, you know, very possibly my screaming wife. I don't know. I don't know what I did, but I did it. So I gotta take it. And we're heading to Michigan. We're going to celebrate Christmas with Nikki's family. And
Christmas?
I can't say the word.
A myth?
It's like, exactly. We're going to celebrate some myths. And I'm going to sit in the corner and I'm going to get drunk and then I'm going to start singing Hanukkah songs. That's probably what will happen. No, that's not true. It's always very fun for me. Love to see the kids open up their presents on Christmas morning and remind them this is, come on, guys, Santa Claus is not real. But ladies and gentlemen, let me just give you a preview of what we have planned for you this week. Tomorrow, as you know, is Thursday. And tomorrow on the program, we will begin our best ofs 2015. Now, I got to put a little asterisk next to that because we have included, I guess, just one from 2014, although we were contemplating that Edward Baptiste also from 2014, because when you start getting around like October 2014, we don't put that on the best of 2014 because it's too close. So we've got to maybe come up with a different system. Maybe we should just do a fiscal new year. And that way we don't ever have that problem. We're like, we're doing a best of a fiscal 2015. But that would have ended in September, which it more or less did. So maybe that's the way we do it from now on.
Yeah, it's nice fiscal, and wonky.
Fiscal, we do. So this is really the best of fiscal year 2015, except for Edward Baptiste, who really technically was in fiscal year 2015, right? Because doesn't the fiscal year start in September? I don't know.
You're asking the wrong guy.
Well, we can just decide when our fiscal year starts. We probably don't even need to do it based on the quarter. It doesn't matter. We're going to have folks like Walter Block, the libertarian professor. Well, I guess we get to have him on again soon. Naomi Klein, Johan Hari, some stuff from the Torch conference I went to this year. People really spoke of it. The interview that I think I probably talk about more, and the story I probably talk about more than any other from 2015, is the story about the Fort Dix Five. And then we're going to have a casual Friday mix next week. And we've got stuff from the Deep Archives for members. So we've got so much for you. The only day that we're not going to be putting out a podcast will be Friday. But on Thursday, we're going to give you a double shot anyways. So you're going to have so much content, you're not even going to know what to do with it. All right. Well, have a good trip. If you're traveling, safe travels. If you need to get coffee, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, don't forget, we rely on your memberships, but you know what? We'll deal with that when we return. All right, folks. So sit back, enjoy this interview with Gary Dorian. It's a little bit weedy, a little bit deep, but I think if you stick with it, it's fascinating stuff and really relevant to what we've been talking about in terms of Black Lives Matter, really relevant what we're talking about when we talk about Bernie Sanders, because he comes out of this tradition as it comes up towards the end. Also, you know, about the different sort of perspectives we have on President Obama, all of it, very fascinating stuff. And then a really interesting conversation about what we could do with Ubers. There's an opportunity here that I think people on the left may be missing. I'm not sure how we get there, but we discuss it in details. So, folks, you should also know that while I'm on vacation, I will probably not be shaving. However, when I get back from vacation and I do start shaving, you know I'm going to be shaving with my Harry's razor. Why? Because it's about half the price of other big branded blades, and they ship it to me for free. They're better, too. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? It's half the price at Harry's, and with Harry's, you'll get a better shave that respects your skin, your face, your legs. I don't know. I guess my daughter has literally told me I should shave my chest. It won't be happening, but I have no problem with other people doing it. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with the promo code Majority Report, you can get $5 off that amazing deal. Ladies, gentlemen, we all need razors that shave well and do not suck. You get it shipped to your door. It's a great deal. And if you go to harrys.com right now, HARRYS.com, Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code Majority Report with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter coupon code Majority Report at checkout for $5 off and start shaving better today. All right. Enjoy today's show.
Good times for a change. See, the luck I've had can make a good man turn bad. So please, 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 let me get what I want this time. Haven't had a dream in a long time. See, the life I've had make a good man.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Gary Dorian is the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. And his latest book, The New Abolition, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel, is linked at majority.fm. Professor, welcome to the program. You know, when we were talking, when I called you, you said, this is one of your more academic styled books. Tell me why were you compelled to write this one?
Well, I've got a lot of books out there on economic democracy and progressive politics and progressive Christianity and the like. That's one whole side of my work deals with subjects of that sort. And So I've been aware for a long time that there are sources within Martin Luther King that just aren't known at all. I've just filled a 700-page book talking about people who are almost completely unknown down the memory hole, including the traditions, you know, that they're in. And I think you can't get King right. You certainly can't get even some of these earlier topics that I've done in other books on progressive, certainly progressive Christianity or Black Church or the Civil Rights Movement. Can't get them right. Can't even really understand what made King himself both distinctive and brilliant, but also part of something, because he didn't come from nowhere, without tracking out this rather difficult, labyrinthine even story that I'm trying to do in these what are going to be two big books on the Black social gospel tradition.
All right, and I want to dig directly into it, but I mean, can we also see, and I know that you've written a little bit about this, and we'll sort of, you know, try and weave some of this in and out, but can we also see what's happening in the sort of the latest generation, or the sort of the next iteration, or I'm not sure what the best way to characterize it is, but you know, when we see a Black Lives Matter movement, this is also not coming out of nowhere. And I mean, I guess how much of what we're seeing today, and you know, as we speak, I believe there are protests in Chicago coming out of, you know, the more videotapes being released on police policing of the Black community. How much of what we're seeing today is also sort of rooted in that, or is that do we need to go back before we can move forward, I guess, in terms of accounting for it?
Yeah, this stuff, every part of this is just exceedingly complicated. I mean, it's complicated historically, and just even what the inheritance is, because there are real connections, and then there are ironies, and then you've got a younger generation reacting to its perception of what went on before, and there's a lot to that, but also a fair amount of it that's not quite making contact with what went before. So you're just always negotiating all of that. Whenever you're having these debates about politics of respectability or what came out of the civil rights movement or what the Black Church stands for, you know, all that complexity is in and around every one of these topics. So certainly, the story I'm telling, I've got in mind the fact that we've got a new Black freedom movement going right now, and it has its own sort of complicated relationship to the story that I'm telling, and so much of what I'm talking about, it's revealing to students when they say, oh my God, you know, they were talking about something so similar 50 years ago, 100 years ago, even 130 years ago. We keep, you know, recapitulating some of these arguments within movements. And then the fact that I am focusing on this tradition of mostly Black church ministers who end up leading to Martin Luther King Jr. is itself something of a, it symbolizes much of what we're grappling with right now, because they are, in fact, very churchly and very male, and they're, you know, they're strapping entrepreneurial church leaders. And we've got a reaction among some of folks in this new Black Freedom movement for whom, yeah, they've heard that all their lives, and that's what they don't want to hear about anymore, is, you know, those ministers. So right now, I'm in churches all the time, and I know a lot of folks who are feeling a little bit on the defensive about this aspect of it. So I think the more we can understand historically about what happened, it at least makes this a richer conversation.
All right, well, let's do that. And then, you know, I want to sort of circle back on sort of the echoes, or I should say maybe the echoes of the same argument that we've heard, or same conversations within these movements that we've heard over the course of the past 150 some odd years. Because, you know, I mean, I think the more that we have had, at least on this program, we've had a lot of interviews that have begun to, at least for me personally, clarify the notion that, at least in the context of this country, the issue of race has been a constant. It's been a constant. There are times where I think, you know, sort of, I guess, as a white person and within the context of white media, the issue of race comes up here and there. Obviously, for a black person, they are far more conscious of it because of the nature of our system. It is constantly reminding them of racial issues. But the dynamic that we have in this country has not, it does not seem to have ebbed and flowed in the way that I think some people perceive it. It has always been there, and it is really just a question of whether or not we've paid attention to it. And so let's go back. Tell us what the black social gospel, now I know this is probably an unfair question, but what is it? What was it?
Well, yeah, I could come at this, you know, from the very beginning. I mean, from the very beginning, it's a reaction to it's ministers in black churches, mostly black churches, some in the mainline Protestant churches, but more AME Zion and what became the National Baptist Convention than in other denominations, simply needing to ask the question, what would a new abolition be? You know, we've already been through an abolitionist movement, and we finally got rid of slavery, and then we had a very brief run of trying to institute some other kind of order, and then they give up on Reconstruction. And it's in the aftermath of Reconstruction that the people who are the founding figures in my sort of black social gospel story, now in a different generation, some of whom are indeed, they're veterans of the abolitionist story, but this is a new moment. It's a different situation. Where they're having to ask, you know, what would a new abolition be? And they are people who are mostly sort of products of, you know, of higher education, and they're in a lot of them big steeple black churches, or they have positions within denominations where they have some kind of authority within the denomination. But they're having to fight for the right to what, to how they understand both Christianity and the political moment. This is one of my big themes in the book, is that the black social gospel is something quite distinctive, but it's also embattled within the black churches themselves from the beginning, and then it's a story of embattlement for almost all these founding figures for the next several decades, because it's a prophetic version of black church Christianity, and it's learning from and in some kind of some kind of alliance with liberal, you know, progressive Christianity, and later on there's going to be a Gandhian proponent, and even later there's going to be a civil religion, you know, aspect of it. So the fact that it's as modernist as it is, and it's as tied to organizations that are trying to get a movement for racial justice going, originally just with black Americans, are not going interracial early on until the Niagara movement fails. It's the minister, one way to track it, it's the ministers who are in the Niagara movement and later who are supporting Du Bois in the NAACP.
Okay.
Although it's broader than that too. Ideologically, I've got four different, you know, tracks.
Okay.
Well,
before we get into the Niagara movement and NAACP, when you say that coming out of Reconstruction, there was, or, you know, with Reconstruction and sort of the rearview mirror as it was, and it's, and there is a conversation about what will be the new abolition, is abolition in that instance, you know, I guess what I'm asking, is it a verb or a noun? In other words, is the question about process, or is the question about goals? In other words, like, what does that make sense? Like,
right. Absolutely, yes, and it's actually both. And that isn't just a black church story, or even a larger black political figures story. That can go across racial lines. It's
right.
Just that's the issue of, if you were an abolitionist before, or if the abolitionists were your heroes, if you cared about, you know, those issues then, If to you the story of this country is mostly a story about, or at least primarily a story about, you know, 246 years of slavery and now what we're in now, well, what does it mean? Who should we be? Because the NAACP, if they had actually named it correctly, the people who were in the NAACP, who were the founders, both on the black and the white side of the founding board, they wanted to call it that. That's how they thought of themselves. We're the new abolitionists. That's what they said. But they also, they didn't name it that because they said if we call it that, we won't have a single Southern chapter. That'll just scare the hell out of the people that the allies were trying to make in the South. So we can't call it that.
Well, so
Du Bois ended up winning on what they're going to call it.
Okay, so what did that mean for the South? I mean, if there were people convinced that if we call ourselves the new abolitionists, what did that mean sort of like concretely? Did that mean that we still perceive the state of black America, I don't know if they would have used that terminology, as one of being essentially still indentured? Is that would have been, what would the implications been, or would it have meant like we are the emancipation, or would it have had specific aspects of emancipation that they were looking for? I mean, what were those? I mean, I imagine this was part of the debate, but I mean, if they were convinced that this would have alienated people in the South, why?
Well, for the founding figures in my story about forming a black social gospel tradition who are ministers in the South, people like Henry McNeil Turner and William Simmons, they're just surrounded by just a totally hostile world. I mean, that's why one track of this is actually nationalist. It's a black nationalist. There's a black nationalist line within the social gospel that just says this country is just so unremittingly and so hopelessly hostile to us that it's pointless to even have any other hope for this, for ourselves, other than just to constitute our own nation. So it grows in the South at a time when most white Southerners don't want black Americans to succeed at anything except picking cotton. I mean, they're against Booker T. Washington, who is the leading figure in one of my four streams of the black social gospel. I mean, Booker T. Washington is this sort of colossal figure who later on is, we type him as just the great accommodator and the great sellout. But in the South, I mean, he was hated in the South for trying to help blacks succeed within a society in which there's almost no support for that at a working class or even middle class level. Booker T. in the South is just trying to hook up with the capitalist class in the South to try to buy a season of peace and, you know, catch a break for a little while because they've got this lynching mania going on. And meanwhile, they're repudiating the 14th and 15th Amendments all through the 1880s and 1890s. Now, narrowly, the NAACP is just going to go after that. We got to be against lynching, and we got to try to get back the 14th and 15th Amendments. Du Bois always has a much wider agenda than that. But in the most narrow sense, that's where the organization they built that finally did get somewhere, that did succeed and really made a difference, is quite assiduously focused on those three things. And to them, if you could abolish lynching and simply restore the 14th and 15th Amendments, that would be a kind of new abolitionism in a context when it's just gone so horribly wrong. Things are just so bad.
So following Reconstruction, when we say advancement of colored people, we're really talking about let's not slip back as close to slavery as we can get without calling it slavery.
Got to start somewhere. I mean, certainly they do that. Du Bois always has a more expansive and I think radical idea of what it even means to draw the line at, you know, what he calls the color line. But there he is running the magazine of the organization that much of which just wants to focus on those three things. And he has a battle on his hands with some of the white liberals in it, and also with most of the black figures on his own on his board in the NAACP, because they don't have his expansive, radical, incipiently socialist, you know, idea about what the NAACP should be. But nonetheless, there he is. He's the public face for the NAACP because he's the one who founded the magazine that's, you know, reaching hundreds of thousands of people. So a debate about, you know, what it means more narrowly or more broadly is in play from the very founding of the NAACP and then its development and then over the next 10 years.
Okay, so you have four streams of, I guess, sort of intellectual thought or social thought that make up what ultimately what you call the Black social gospel,
right?
And so one of them is embodied in Du Bois, and like you say, it's his is sort of a broader agenda as broad of an agenda as possible. The others is Booker T. Washington, who is at the very least, just basically trying to maintain. Fit in? Is this the respectability politics that we talk about, or is it even beyond that?
Well, let's bracket that for a moment, because respectability politics is everywhere in this story of one kind or another. But Booker T. Yeah, the Great Accommodator. I mean, he's an enormous figure, and enormously successful, and his following is just. Is very difficult for it to imagine. It's just so colossal. And so there's a vast clerical following, and plenty of people who are in the kind of social gospel movements are just down the line with Booker T. That's what's going to get us somewhere. But Booker T is against protest politics. He's not against what's actually the agenda of the NAACP, because privately, Booker T is funding and supporting efforts to try to stop this spread of, you know, losing 14th and 15th Amendment rights all through the South. But he's quiet about that, and he's wily. He's very political. The Du Bois group is they're against that. That kind of politics is demeaning. It's degrading. It's not working anyway. And so, therefore, you know, a protest politics for privileging the issue of racial justice. And it's important to me, you know, to argue that faction, that group existed, that tradition existed before Du Bois comes into it and then becomes the leader of it. Part of my problem is that these ministers who are in this picture end up being overshadowed by the debate between Du Bois and Washington, because that sat right in the middle of who they are. And so then they all end up becoming forgotten because, you know, Du Bois comes along and is just so brilliant that, you know, all the spotlight goes on him. And then we just totally forget all these church people who were part of this struggle.
Okay.
But that's two of them. Yeah. Nationalist line too. The nationalist group, just says we've got to have our own nation, maybe even back to Africa. Because this country is just hopelessly hostile to us. And then the fourth strain are the people who want to have it both ways, with Du Bois and Washington. You know, a lot of them they're pastors of churches like Adam Clayton Powell Sr. up in Abyssinian, for whom they have friends on both sides of this partisan divide. And a lot of people who come to church, they don't want to argue about, you know, they don't want to have to take a side, in which, you know, they both sound good. So you have the trimmer types who are trying to pull at both ends.
And so just to be clear, when we talk about the essentially, I guess, what would be the Niagara movement, this is Du Bois movement in the really around the turn of the century. And the disagreement they had with Booker T. Washington's movement that I guess sort of culminated in the Atlanta Agreement. Is that what?
Right.
So,
well, there were three passes at trying to create a black only racial justice organization. There was the Afro American League, which Thomas Fortune founded in the 1880s, and that had a brief run, and it failed. And then there was another run at it that Fortune was part of, that one of my several of the folks in my story, Alexander Walters and others, are part of, called the Afro-American Council. And that one was starting to get somewhere. They had an anti-lynching bureau. Ida Wells was speaking for it, and it looked like it might really get somewhere, which is why Booker T. now needs to come in to take it over, because Booker T. Washington could not allow a protest organization to go on that he didn't, you know, dominate. So he came in and basically corrupted it, took it over. So you had now a second organization that has not worked, although it keeps going along. When Du Bois founded the Niagara Movement, it was as a kind of, okay, one more try at this, an attempt to create a racial justice protest organization that is emphatically against Booker T. and what all that has represented.
Was there
and that had a brief run.
Was there a dispute? Was that dispute a function of tactics, or was it a function of you know, the idea of integrity? I mean, I'm unclear as to what was it just simply tactics, or was there a sense that Booker T. Washington was it like, you know, personally, like, this is not a good, these leaders are corrupted in some way, or are stooges in some way that benefit them personally? What was that?
Yeah, to many people in the story and to a lot of people who are observers looking in, it does seem like just an argument about tactics, as you say, right? But for many others in it, and certainly to Du Bois and to the folks in my story, what we're calling tactics goes to something way deeper. It's existential. You know, this is just what Booker T's prescription is: demeaning, it's degrading, it's humiliating. And so therefore can't be right. And also it was white people who made him number one anyway. And so they have a kind of grievance against Booker T. and his machine. Although so much of the argument that went on in those early years had to do with higher education. And this is what can get a little hard to tease out, because there are plenty of people in the story saying, just in the spirit of your question, saying you guys are just arguing about tactics, because Booker T. isn't actually against higher education for Black Americans, right? He just believes that it's, you know, just a handful who are going to make it. And in truth, Du Bois himself says that. Du Bois talks all the time during that period about what he calls the talented tenth. So in some ways, he's every bit as elitist. He's even more elitist in some ways than Washington. This is another sort of complicating factor. That even though Du Bois really is on the side of protest politics and radical democracy and all that, and that's what he means historically, he is, after all, you know, coming out of an elite. He's the first Black, you know, American to get a PhD from Harvard. And it feels to many in this story like he's looking down on people. Meanwhile, here's Booker T. You know, he came up from slavery, and his degree's from Hampton, and he's always with ordinary people. At least he's never too much out of contact with them. So that's a complicating factor in how, you know, who's an elitist and who isn't, is murky during this whole period. Now, what matters in the end is that Du Bois is on the side of saying, we cannot be deprived of our right to protest against injustice and against losing our rights and being degraded and being demeaned. And so that appeal to a certain kind of racial pride and also to the politics that go with it is what, you know, we now, what we associate with Du Bois during that period. And Booker T., for all the good that he did, he's on the whole other side of that debate.
Does these four strains that come together in the context of, I guess, forming, you know, the Black social gospel, do these strains remain? I mean, how far into the future from this time in the early 1900s, I guess, does this go forward? And then sort of tease out for us, you know, what it is that we're looking at when we look at when we look at the movements of the 60s, and then give us a sense of, like, you know, what we're looking at today.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, this in the conversations I've had with different folks involved and Black Lives Matter and talking about, you know, and particularly in the context really of like debates around President Obama from black intellectual life, there seems to be, two pretty big camps. That, you know, particularly in terms of the way that they perceive President Obama. And then there also seems to be not necessarily consistent with that, a perspective of black activists today on the way that they perceive the remnants of the civil rights leadership.
That's right. And I've got way more at stake in how King comes out than how Obama comes out, you know, in this debate. Yes.
Well, I mean, tell us how King comes out in the.
Well, firstly, you asked about the how the four traditions sort of play out. I think they do. They go on. It's what really matters to me, of course, is the line that came out of this fourfold discussion and debate, that is the Du Bois line. That leads through people like Reverdy Ransom and William Simmons and Richard Wright Jr. and George Washington Woodbey into the next generation, which becomes Mordecai Johnson, Benjamin Mays, Howard Thurman, Pauli Murray, and people like that. And that's what leads to King, and then the King generation. So that's the line that I've got my eye on, and more as they get it, as Volume One gives way to Volume Two, it goes hard for. How the radical civil rights movement happened, just who these figures were and where they came from. But it's not to say that these other lines just disappeared. By no means. They're very much in evidence all around us. Yet Booker T was still a great figure. In American life and in histories of the black church and the like, black American history and the like, really up till the Black Power period. It's only with circa 1965, 67, in that period, when the Black Power movement comes along, that Booker T became someone that you just stigmatize. I mean, just, you know, you sort of can't touch him because he's the one who sold us out. So that line, I've known, you know, many ministers, still do, who very much revere Booker T and who kind of regret what happened to his reputation.
Interesting.
In the 1970s. And certainly the people who say, got to have it both ways. You know, Booker T was right, but so was Du Bois. I've known lots of ministers. I know lots of ministers for whom something like that dialectic is still the one that kind of grounds them, you know, holds them together. And then the nationalist line as well, that appeal to a kind of rock bottom kind of racial pride that can lead to separatism, that's just a source of strength for many in the black community. And, you know, that's the more genuine article here, that nationalist line.
Can you give us a sense of just sort of, I mean, and you know, obviously, like, you know, the legacy of King, or I should say, maybe not the legacy is the right word, but the antecedents to
yeah.
King, are in your portfolio. And I raise Obama really more as a watershed, because it seems to be, you know, sort of he is, I don't know if it's fair to say a Rorschach test in some ways, but it's, you know, I see that delineation. Obama tends to be a touchstone for that delineation, and almost a shorthand in terms of the perspective on Obama. But when you talk about there still being ministers that you know that still revere Booker T. Washington, and I assume that there's also ministers out there who revere Du Bois.
Sure.
Where do we see, for those of us who don't have that level of insight into these streams of intellectual and social movements, where do we see the reflection of it today? So in other words, when we're watching the news today and we see the Black Lives Matter activists, or when we see Al Sharpton's organization going into lead a parade like we saw in New York in response to the same thing that the Black Lives Matter is responding to. Is there a shorthand that we can have that you can tell us, like, where those lines match up? In other words, can you give us the 101 survey course here on how to sort of get a sense, at least even a rudimentary sense, of what we're watching? I mean, obviously, it's not going to be as in-depth as the volumes you're writing, but even a shorthand, so the people want to start to dig into this more and, take bite-sized pieces as they go. Yeah. And I understand the danger in that. But can you give us a sense of that? Is that possible? Is that too simplistic?
Well, there is something that's just crucial to me, and that is getting King right and understanding the civil rights movement and getting it right. My whole two-volume project is sort of heading in that direction to try to do that. When Cornel West, when he talks about King, he always says, there are four principal intellectual and existential sources that just shaped King. One is what he calls prophetic Black Church Christianity, and the second one is prophetic liberal Christianity, and the third one is prophetic Gandhian nonviolence, and the fourth one he calls prophetic American civil religion. And I think that argument is exactly right, although I spend 1.5 volumes showing that very apt description of King is itself a perfectly apt description of the Black social gospel tradition that produced King, that's exactly what the Black social gospel was and had become when King got so much of it from his mentors like Mordecai Johnson and Benjamin Mays and people like that. So teasing all that out and just getting it is crucial to me. And then I would say that the weakest link in that whole chain of four things is the one that white America lifted up after King was gone. It's King the dreamer who called America to its own creed. And King himself, played down that trope in his later life. It didn't comport very well with the Black Power movement, and King himself was more radical and angry throughout his career. I mean, he is more radical and angry in 1960 than he was in 1955, and more of both in 1965 than he would have been in 1960, and he was more of both at the end than ever. In fact, near the end, King was the most radical person in his entire circle. He had to drag the SCLC into the Poor People's Movement into Washington. He had to drag them into Chicago before that. So I think understanding, just grasping how truly radical King was and the SCLC is enormously important here, because oftentimes when we talk about these things, it's King the stereotype, King the epitome of some white liberal ideal that's put in play, and then we argue about how we feel about that, and more we do have a next generation who's just heard enough about King's dream.
It's fascinating, because I don't know if you're familiar with Professor Eddie Gloud at Princeton. Well, I had the opportunity to read his forthcoming book, and he has a couple of chapters on the revisionism that both Reagan and Clinton engaged in terms of King, and that trope that you're talking about, the idea of living up to the American ideals as opposed to seeing the white supremacy and racism sort of embedded in those ideals. So I wonder, when you talk about Cornel West's distinction of those four sort of traditions that embodied King and also the Black social gospel, what part of that was the part that sort of small part that, you know, people want to hang their hat on in terms of the ideal. Is that the civil religion?
Oh, sure. You know, it's that, you know, we're basically a good country, but we haven't quite lived up to it in trying to get the United States to live up the best meaning of its creed. And many of King's signature speeches in the late 50s and early 1960s do, in fact, work that theme very hard. And I think it's always there in him. But it's the one that was sort of valorized and, you know, lifted up during that long campaign to get the King holiday. And the fact that King was a socialist, the fact that, it's hard to obscure that he did take on President Johnson over the war, but what becomes harder to remember later on is just what that required. I mean, the fact that he took on almost the entire civil rights establishment when he did so, and people around him, that was considered just radical, just off the map.
Of those other
when
three
he takes
traditions,
on Lyndon Johnson over the war.
Over those other three traditions, what does that radicalism? Which of those traditions sort of added that radicalism, or can account for that type of radicalism? When you talk about the prophetic black church and the prophetic white church?
Yeah, you really need them all, right, I think, to get this the black social gospel and to get King. I think his distinct brilliance is that, yes, he's inherited a tradition of people who are like this. This is their worldview, but by virtue of, you know, of epitomizing it, he was able to just brilliantly hold together groups and things that normally didn't hold together very well, because he's comfortable. He's totally comfortable in very different worlds. He can speak to white church audiences and black church audiences, and he'll do it in different ways. Just the fact that he was able to hold together the Southern civil rights movement and the Northern civil rights movement is just an enormous task, and no one else comes close to doing it the way that he did. So it's that brilliant capacity to straddle worlds while really standing for something and then moving the needle that I think is what's so extraordinary about him. But it isn't just him. It's there's a whole tradition of folks that he is part of, and he is accountable to, and who is inspiring him and helping him along the way too.
Lastly, let me ask you this: in the context, I mean, of you're compelled to write this book, and at the very least, or at least, you know, sort of the prominent reasons are so that this tradition that lived in King and is, you know, has been. Almost, you know, it has been actively disremembered. Is there other examples in, you know, as a historian, as an intellectual historian on some level, are there other examples of where you see this and what the implications are of it? In other words, you know, if we were, or the opposite way of asking that question, I guess, would be, if we did properly remember King for who he was and all the things that we take from King that we, as a society sort of hold up and are cheery about, and, you know, that is all sort of like easily digested by all of us. If that was associated and understood in the context of everything else that he was really standing for, that was far more radical, what would be the implications of that? Do you understand? I guess I'm asking the question in both ways. What's the implication of disremembering the lineage of some in history, or what's the reverse if we remember it?
I think if you don't remember, we are sort of tempted to despair and then to a kind of year zero apocalypticism or utopianism, in which you just, you don't really, you're not anchored, you're not feeling that you're part of anything that went before, that you're part of some sort of cloud of witnesses to something that that existed before your time. And so you feel like you just have to make it up yourself in your own time. And then that itself is kind of self-defeating. If you can't sort of make a claim to, or if you're actually trying to change structures of justice in the United States, if you can't claim linkages to earlier traditions where people saw something quite similar, that it didn't just start with you, then I think that is terribly important. So yes, there are several examples of that in my own sort of life or work. I have similar arguments about trying to help white progressive church people realize that they've got a history, and that, you know, there is no ecumenical movement without the very things that they're part of, and that tends to get forgotten as well. I think Bernie Sanders is having, you know, a problem with this right now. Partly it's a problem of how much of this he simply wants to go into. But, you know, the fact that there are, you know, traditions of American democratic socialism and radicalism and the kind of politics that Sanders has that go way back, that include some great figures, and that, you know, he is part of and clearly played roles in nurturing him. And yet he gets kind of tongue-tied when it comes to sort of talking about, you know, who and what and why, because I think he's afraid it won't play or what. But it then leaves you kind of looking kind of lonely and stranded.
That's interesting. And I imagine he would, I mean, the one constituency that he must, if he's going to have a chance in this presidential primary, is the black community. Yeah. And that and not, I guess, highlighting and articulating that his politics comes out of, at least in part, in that tradition, I guess, is doing him and perhaps those people a great disservice.
Yeah, I think so.
Gary Dorian, the book is The New Abolition, W.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Haven't had a dream in a long time. See, the life I've had can make a good man bad. So for once in my life, let me get what I want. Lord knows it would be the first time. Lord knows it would be the first time.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Michal Rozarski. He is a Toronto-based union researcher and writer, writer for the Jacobin magazine, and also hosts a political podcast that is largely focused on Canadian politics, but not totally, called Political Economy. We will link to it. Welcome to the program, Michal.
Hi, thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, so let's talk about this this piece that you have in the Jacobin, Why We Fight Uber. I guess the subtitle is The Fight Against Uber Isn't Technophobia. It's a fight for technology that could foster real cooperation. What do you mean by that?
Well, I originally posted this as a blog piece, and I called it Uber and the Luddites. And the idea was to sort of harken back to this old sort of maybe not even as much forgotten as misunderstood sort of tradition of opposition to not so much technology in itself, but the way it's being used and the way it's being used to create injustices for workers when the technology itself could actually be quite liberating. And I think Uber is a very good example of this, where on the one hand, people who are critical of it are often painted as technophobes. And on the other hand, it's, of all the various things, it's actually relatively a no-brainer to turn something like Uber into a workers' co-op or some other form. That's what I mean by sort of the genuine cooperation, that there's ways to do something very similar using the technology we have in a way that actually fosters, for example, you know, worker management and self-management.
All right, let's back up just a little bit, because as I say this, I mean, you know, it is, I think it in at least in big cities, I think people are quite aware of what Uber is. But, you know, just for the sake of due diligence, people should know that Uber is an app that, or I should say it's obviously a larger than app, but it's an app that essentially brokers that brokers drivers. And, you know, initially it started out as, you know, people just wanted to use their car at the moment. And then sort of more particularly like in New York, we're seeing, you know, professional drivers, whether they were cab drivers or they, and sometimes they can remain cab drivers, or livery drivers, or, and then people entering into the business. And it's really, they're not entering into the business, and we can talk about this in a minute too. They're independent contractors, and they're basically, they give a cut to Uber to be essentially a dispatcher. It's just a dispatcher that's delivered via an app. There are competitors out there, Lyft and others, I imagine. But that is like sort of the nuts and bones of it. But characterize it in sort of more general terms. Like, what is it doing? You know, I look at my app, I see the pictures of the car coming around or whatever it is, and I can say, I'm standing right here, you know, come pick me up. But what is it really doing behind that? I mean, what is that? How does the exchange of capital go? How does explain that to us.
I mean, I think you characterized it fairly well. I mean, Uber prides itself on, you know, not having workers. It has business partners, right? So all these people with cars who are independent contractors. And that's basically it. You know, it's sort of like it's a sort of transactional platform, or, you know, they'll use big words like, you know, revolutionizing the world of what have you, like all Silicon Valley firms do. But they're basically putting people in touch with each other, but at the same time, sort of offloading the risk onto them. And by this, I mean onto the drivers, onto the individual contractors. So where you would have had a cab company before, you know, that depends on the city. But, you know, oftentimes the owners of either a cab company or owners of license of cab sort of medallions or license plates or whatever their existence in a certain city would actually like own the cabs, be responsible for upkeep, be responsible for, you know,
insurance.
like occupational insurance, occupational health and safety, all these kinds of things would, you know, be quite mindful of like anti-discrimination laws, all this kind of stuff. Uber basically is just putting people in touch with one another through this app. And they, you know, the app is quite good. It works very well. They've got a lot of sort of, you know, what's called sort of first mover advantage, that they were one of the first ones to really popularize this. They've put a lot of money because they don't need to put profits into investment into exactly like into a lot of capital other than, you know, server space and some other things. They can put a lot of money into PR, advertising, and lobbying. And they've been very successful at that. And they've, you know, really entered markets where either local governments have tried to stop them or have tried to put up regulations. They've been very good at lobbying their way out of it. And that's because that's what they can put their money towards. I mean, another way of putting this is like a sort of 30-second version. It's a very sort of neoliberal solution. And others have put it this way, and I think that's one of the best ways of putting this. Like a lot of the other so-called sharing economy things, it's a very neoliberal solution to say the problem of there being too few cabs or something like that, or a bad distribution of cab licenses. It's very individual level, and it offloads a lot of risk onto workers.
And so, you know, we should, another way I think to illustrate this is that, you know, the story we're told of capitalists, why capitalists deserve the money, why the not the management class, but that sort of the capital, the capitalists, those who have the money, why they deserve the profits they get is because they're the ones who are taking their money, and they're the ones who are subjecting themselves to such enormous risk with their money. And it's like they could lose everything they have. And if there's a payoff, that's why their payoff is so big. And in the old system, we would have, you know, like you say, I start a cab company. I'm going to buy a medallion in New York City. Depending on when I buy this, $500,000, $750,000. I invest in that, and then I go out and I get I buy a cab and I pay for the insurance on the cab, and I have an infrastructure and I have a dispatcher and I pay for all these things. And then I hope that there's enough customers so that I get a profit. In this instance, it was more, building on the backs of technology, a good idea. They were the first ones to have it, or at least they were the first ones to implement this idea. But there's an enormous amount of stuff that they are, like you say, offloading to the drivers, to society, too, in many respects, by sort of attacking our regulatory structure. And this is, when people talk about rentiers, this is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really sort of the 21st century rentier capitalism, and it's ideal. It's what the capitalists, I'm sure, in the 30s or whenever would have dreamed of, that they have this ephemeral, relatively immaterial product. Obviously, again, sort of server space, customer service centers, what have you. But they're able to take a cut off it, and all the risks that they normally would have carried go on to other people. And I think it's sort of also a symbol of the kind of, low level in some ways of innovation and dynamism of today's capitalism that's sort of stuck in this stagnation for a bit of time. And we had, the dot-com boom, but all the sort of main technologies, the internet, smartphones, GPS, it's sort of like Uber's sort of free riding on this, and we're supposed to marvel over this sort of glorified gypsy cab service, right? That's sort of brought into the 21st century. But in some ways, it represents a low level of innovation and a high level of sort of regulatory or deregulatory innovation that they're able to pull this off.
So, let me get a sense of like sort of characterizing, what beyond that you're arguing, because, to play devil's advocate, I would say to you, you resent the fact that they, came up with this app, that it works well, they put the money into it, maybe they haven't taken as much risk as you think that they should take to justify their profits, but if they're not taking that much risk, why didn't you do it? I mean, right? What are you just complaining or what? What is the point of this analysis in terms of where we go with this? Is it, should we outlaw these things or what is it?
I think that's a good question. I think for me, the major thing is really the effect it has on workers, and in a sort of more abstract way, what it says about the sort of transformations of our economy, but in a very concrete way, what it does to, in the case of Uber, this small class of whatever, like cab drivers, of short-term kind of driver services and their providers and the workers who do this. Of course, if that argument's made, or you get the argument that, the cab industry is, horrible, so they're coming in and they're they love the word disrupting it and really making it better. Where the main counter argument is, there's no point in replacing one crappy thing with another one, and where the other one, it might actually distribute the gains and losses in a way that's really unfavorable to the workers. So I don't think it's a case of sour grapes. Outlawing it here it's counteracting the kind of, like I said before, the kind of regulatory innovation that this company's been able to leverage. And again, you could actually, at the cost of drivers who consistently have seen that, you know, Uber comes into a city, the rates there, sort of the cut for the drivers, which is set by Uber, is quite good at the beginning, and drivers, you know, make more than a cabbie would, or if they already are cabbies, they're making more than they would be if they were driving under a cab license for that time. But pretty much in every market, after a few years, once Uber establishes itself, the cut to drivers goes down, sometimes by half, sometimes by more. And people are left working, you know, for the equivalent of less than minimum wage. But of course, because they're not workers, they're independent contractors, they're stuck with it. Whereas all Uber is doing, like we've been talking, is really just connecting people. And able to put the money that it generates into maintaining its market position. And I mean, so another person, there was another article in Jacobin, actually, I think this year, written by Seth Ackerman, who said, you know, listen, there's a very simple solution. Why don't you just say that all ride sharing services of this sort of model, you know, that rely on independent contractors or what have you, have to be, for example, worker co-ops. Have to be worker managed. That's the kind of ordinance that a local government could bring in. There's lots of local ordinances that, you know, regulate certain kinds of businesses. And then you could let the drivers self-organize. Uber could still be an app maker, and the drivers could use the app in that market. But the drivers themselves would be responsible for saying, you know, what are the rates? Who gets what cut? How do we deal with insurance? Do we pool our risk? Do we get common insurance? What do we do about safety regulations and all these kinds of things?
So just to reiterate, and because I think the thing that caught my eye about your piece was, you know, just sort of contemplating that very notion, just like looking around at these Uber drivers, and the preschool that I send my son to is a co-op. The supermarket I go to is a co-op, and as a customer of both those things, and also a worker there, it's, you know, I save my money that way. But if I was strictly a worker at those things, I mean, it seems like this is something that there wouldn't be too hard to set up. So I guess the idea is, we need to have a greater awareness of what something like Uber is, what the potential downside. And because, you know, from a customer experience perspective, just, you know, for instance, I know at least a couple of folks, black folks, who are like, you know, taxis just didn't work for me. I would not get picked up with a taxi. With Uber, you know, I put it in there. I get essentially a ride, whereas I wouldn't get a taxi before. And so there's definitely an upside to the technology. It is really, I guess, just a question of, you know, people need to expand their imagination as to who can control that technology. And as far as the city ordinances, you know, we just saw Seattle days ago vote that despite the fact that Uber perceives its drivers as independent contractors, and despite the fact that that would mean that they fall outside of the National Labor Relations Act, that the city in and of itself can say, we're going to authorize these people to unionize if they so decide to. So now I'm not sure what the percentage, I think maybe it could be just a majority of those people who have ever worked for Uber. And I wonder, you know, I imagine Seattle has certain specifications. They can now vote to form a union. And in the context of Seattle, if Uber wants to operate there, they have to recognize, if those drivers vote to form a union, they have to recognize the validity of the union. And so that at least is a precedent for, you know, saying how a company that comes into your city, can function.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly it. And I think that's the really important point to remember. And what kind of makes this argument hard is that these things, yes, they're extremely convenient. Consumers roundly love them, whether it's Uber or Airbnb. And you're not, you know, we're not going to get far by just sort of saying no, bad technology, bad smartphone, bad, you know, what, sure, it's convenient, whatever. It's, there's this thing that has enormous potential, but we have to recognize the sort of harms it's causing and the way that the gains and losses from it are distributed. And there's, like you said, there's lots of ways to do this, but it's ultimately a question of how the technology is controlled and how it's used and who decides, and whether it's, you know, whether it's just sort of a free for all Wild West thing that we have now. And it's not even actually a Wild West thing, because like I said a couple of times, you know, Uber has enormous resources that it puts into lobbying, that it puts into regulatory fights to win its own advantage. So it's not even, you know, the idea of this being some sort of free market and let the best app win, it's completely false. Uber and a lot of the other Silicon Valley search sharing economy firms have been hiring a lot of political operatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, Uber had David Plouffe as their main PR person. They fired him, but they hired someone who's an ex-Google exec, but also ran John McCain's last presidential campaign, I believe.
That's the tell, so, right? That's the tell that they're in the business of government relations, because they need to roll back and they need to have a regulatory structure that favors them. That's the big tell.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the thing. It's, you know, their PR person isn't the person who made Coca-Cola's last right. billboard. It's the person who has access to Washington, who has access to politicians at all levels, and who's going to win them this leg up. That, you know, that they don't need the other sort of advertising as much, that this is sort of a lot more effective.
Right. And I think the message that people should get from this is that, you know, when you look at Uber, it is one part a technology story and really two parts a political story. And that means that if that is the case, that means that there are decisions being made by those who purport to represent our society that could be made a different way. And the benefits of this technology could be used in a different way. So not so that the Uber executives and the people who developed the app wouldn't make some money, but also that, you know, we can all share in the infrastructure and that they're basically exploiting and the infrastructure that was built by society.
Exactly. And the fact that, you know, and really showing which narrow slice, and they, you know, they do it themselves. They say, we don't have employees. They're proud of this fact. Okay. If you don't have employees, if you're really just an app provider, okay, be an app provider. Let there be worker cooperatives in every city that provide these services, and you provide the app, this great platform that uses all these great technologies that allows people to interact with this co-op, but be the app provider that you claim to be, rather than, you know, skimming every little piece of this service off and leaving people with big risks.
And that, and, you know, that puts the responsibility too on the drivers, right? I mean, this is something like, you know, that drivers and people who are in these industries, they're going to have to, you know, it's incumbent upon all of us to sort of like remind them of the context that they can do this, but ultimately they're going to have to do it. I mean, the irony of Seattle saying to Uber that these people can form a union is that in some ways it distracts people from saying, like, or they could just become a business and you just could become one of their providers, right? I mean, they got to buy cars, they got to buy a cell phone service, and you can just be basically their dispatch mechanism.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it, and that's what they're doing anyways, right?
Right.
And I wanted to make one more point, like the point of anti-discrimination things. I mean, there's the other side too. So, for example, with someone, you know, where you would have had a regulation, for example, that a certain number of cabs have to be in a city or in a company have to be sort of disabled friendly. Now, with a sea of independent contractors, that's basically unenforceable with Uber, right? Or it doesn't, like, how do you mandate that Uber has a certain number of disability adapted cabs if they say we don't have any cabs, right? So, I mean, I think the point is to take the things, like you said, like where there is racial discrimination by cab drivers, which is horrible, and there's ways to fight that. And then there's other kinds of discrimination that this new system can bring in. So the point is it's a hard argument to make, but like I said, you know, there's things that are wrong with the current system, but just bringing in another system because it's new, and because it's, you know, built on this model of disruption, doesn't automatically make it better or fair or just. And in many ways, it could be worse. And also in many ways, it could easily be transformed. You know, we talk often about trying to get reforms and transform this or that in the economy. It's a lot, you know, easier to transform Uber into worker co-ops than it is to transform, you know, your neighborhood power plant or your school or whatever into a co-op, and to really, you know, democratize some sort of small piece of the economy.
Maybe
which
it's
really
it's,
primed for that.
It's time for the drivers to disrupt Uber.
Exactly.
Michal Rozarski, thank you so much for your time today. We will link to your piece in the Jacobin and your podcast, Political Economy.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks again for having me. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay to play in. I know somehow the lines got graded somewhere before the credits faded. But my pilot light shining, pilot light shining bright.